All right, we're going in our Bibles to Exodus chapter 22 this morning. Exodus chapter 22. We're going to start in verse 16. We're going to read down through verse 9 of chapter 23. Exodus 22, beginning in verse 16. If a man seduces a virgin who's betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath will burn and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall become widows. Your children shall become fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him. You shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he surely cries to me, I will surely hear, for I am compassionate. You shall not revile God, nor shall you curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with his mother, and the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be consecrated to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. The idea is, instead, you shall throw it to the dogs. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil. Nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many, so as to turn away or pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted, and it subverts the cause of those who are in the right. You shall not oppress a sojourner. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You're going to get sick of this picture. But this is the context for the rest of the book of Exodus. Everything that's happening from now through the end of the book happens right here at Mount Sinai. And again, God is building what is becoming a covenant community. It's a community, it's a corporate community that God is entering into covenant with. There's going to be obligations from them. And God is going to hold himself to his own obligations. And he's going to put himself in a context with this community. And we're going to see very shortly after this covenant is established that it's still a rebel community. Even though it's a redeemed community, it's a rebel community. But as God has redeemed this community and brought them to himself, in the desert, before he brings them into the promised land to give them an inheritance in his presence, he's establishing for them some core values. We went through the Ten Commandments and we saw in particular the Ten Commandments with reference to God, referenced his holiness. And because he is holy, they are called to be holy. We saw that that fourth commandment focused particularly on the grace of God, that these people can't earn their way into God's presence. In fact, they can't do anything to essentially benefit God. All things come from God and are given to man. And this covenant, even though it's entered into with obligations on both sides, is cemented in grace. We've seen that a core value within the community, especially and particularly as they operate in conjunction with one another on this horizontal scale, it's to be governed by love, a love that is first demonstrated by this grace-giving God and then extended through his people in such a way that their love that manifests his love is what sets them apart. It is what makes them holy. And these become the core values of this covenant community out there in the desert. As God gave the Ten Commandments, those were the what we call apodictic law. Those are the bare bones, straight up, in theory, these are the things that are supposed to happen. What God moves into right after that is called case law. If this, then this. If this, then this. And so you'll see a lot of if-then clauses in these chapters that we're in at present. It's where these truths that are abstract are brought down into real life and the rubber is supposed to meet the road. What we come to at this point is a series on ethics. When we come to ethics, we're talking about goodness. We've taken time this past week on Memorial Day to remember our fallen heroes. And as we have, we're reminded of the greatness of this nation, the United States of America. We're reminded of what's been termed American exceptionalism. It's without argument that America has been and continues to be the greatest nation on earth. But what is it that has made America great? There was, at least in the minds of our founding fathers, a direct association between a nation's greatness and a nation's goodness. A nation's greatness and a nation's goodness. And as God is calling his holy people, Israel, into holiness, he's calling them into greatness. He's inspiring them to be something more than what they are, a ragtag bunch of slaves out in the desert, out in no man's land, wandering about like a bunch of Bedouins with a couple of sheep, a couple of oxen, no vineyards, no houses, just tents to live in. God's calling them to become a great people that reflect his greatness. But the only way they can become a great people is if they become a good people. Now, the laws wouldn't make them good, but as they put themselves under and submit to a holy God and look at his goodness and take into account his goodness and keep track of his goodness and acknowledge their badness, and he's going to give them the book of Leviticus to do exactly that, to deal with their sin before this holy God. But God says, you will be great in the degree that you will be good. You cannot separate the one from the other. This was on the very lips of our founding fathers, America's first president, George Washington. You see him there at Valley Forge. You're familiar with the picture. It's a picture I keep in my office. My dad gave it to me when I graduated from seminary. It reminds me that the great work that I have to do can only be carried forth on my knees. It's not just because I'm a pastor. It's the work that I do as a dad. It's the work that I do as a husband. It's the work that I do as an American citizen. It's the work that I do as a friend. It's what we do as Christians. We reflect our God. We do the work of our God on our knees. Listen to how George Washington connected greatness and goodness. He says, "Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained apart from religion. Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. 'Tis substantially true that virtue or morality is a necessary spring of popular government." You can't have a people who will rule themselves if they're not a people who know how to be good, who contain themselves, who restrain themselves. John Adams, he says this, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled for morality and religion. This can never be a great government if we unbridle ourselves from our goodness. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. This freedom that we enjoy, if it's a freedom unto licentiousness, it's a freedom unto our own bondage. It's not a freedom unto greatness. Later on again, it's George Washington who says this: "The citizens of America, placed in the most enviable condition as the sole lords and proprietors of a vast tract of continent, comprehending all the various soils and climates of the world and abounding with all the necessaries and conveniences of life, are now by the late satisfactory pacification acknowledged to be possessed of absolute freedom and independency. They are from this period to be considered as the actors of a most conspicuous theater, which seems to be peculiarly designated by Providence for the display of human greatness." George Washington says, listen, in all of time and history, and with the recent battles that have been fought and won at great expense, we are poised as a people to play out on the theater of this world the greatness of mankind. He continues with this: "I now make it my earnest prayer that God would most graciously be pleased to dispose us all to do justice, to love mercy, and to demean ourselves with that charity, humility, and pacific temper of mind which were the characteristics of the divine author of our blessed religion, and without an humble imitation of whose example in these things we can never hope to be a happy nation." Our proposition this morning is simply this: a holy people will never stand out as great until they learn to stand up as good. Who among us doesn't want to have some level of greatness? You want to stand out. You want to be a little bit different. You want to be head and shoulders above the crowd. You want to push your kids to not just get by. You want to help them to be able to soar, to be able to rise up and become what God created them to be. If we would truly have that as our desire, to stand out in the work that God's called us to do, we have to stand up to be a moral people, to be a good people. Last week, we looked at goodness, that it's particularly revealed in our attitude to the things that we possess. Ownership. All we own comes from God and is to be used for God. We'll have open hands, is the word that he uses, regarding our goods, holding them loosely because they come from God. Our welfare is tied to the welfare of our neighbors. As we are blessed, our neighbors are blessed. As we suffer, our neighbors suffer. As our neighbors are blessed, we are blessed. As our neighbors suffer, we suffer. It sounds pretty New Testament, doesn't it? Rejoice with them that do rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Life is more valuable than possessions. That's why you don't kill the thief when he's coming in during the day. Number five, relationships are more valuable than possessions. So that means if you take something from somebody, you owe it to them to be able to repair the relationship. The whole purpose isn't necessarily restoring the goods. The whole purpose is restoring the relationship and then restoring that individual within the community. Relationships are valued properly when responsibility is taken for the losses that are inflicted on others. And then possessions become a tangible reflection of what is goodness, tangible test. Am I in fact putting God first and others before myself? God, as he was talking about our possessions, was setting it in this context of goodness. I've called you to be a great people, and it has to begin with your willingness to not get, but to give, to let go. As we move into this text, and we have very little time this morning before we come to the Lord's Supper, we're going to see five more considerations of community ethics. Very quickly this morning, we'd like to run through those. Number one is this: the high price of inordinate affections. It's never fun when the first thing in the text is premarital sex. That just sets a tone, okay? But the first thing that God talks about in this text right here, and there's some question, does this text go with what preceded it about possessions and making retribution? Or does it come into the next text that deals with social justice? And you can put it in either set. We're putting it here because even though the next three things that he talks about require a death penalty, what he's talking about is an affection that's misplaced. It's inordinate. It's out of order. The first thing he talks about is desiring a good thing in a bad way. We don't use the word sex in public, but in the context that he gives it to us, God wasn't ashamed to talk about it. He said, listen, I have made everything, and everything I've made is good. In fact, it's very good, God says. And as we talk with our children, as we talk with another generation, as we talk with each other, even about sex, we don't want to avoid the subject. We want to be the ones who are talking about it. We want to own the discussion on sex because we want it to be couched in the knowledge that God created it and He created it for good. But sex becomes bad when this good thing is desired the wrong way. And what happens in this text is a man seduces, he coerces, he tricks, he persuades somebody who's not engaged. If she had been engaged, this would have been adultery and their lives would have been required. But he persuades her to have sex with him. And these laws are meant to help God's people to understand that God demands a right to everything in your life, not just your possessions, but even to your very body itself. God set up a context in which sex is to take place. It's only in the context of marriage. It's only in the context of marriage. And that marriage, this text in particular points out, that marriage is in the context of community. It's never just about two people who fall in love with each other and commit themselves to each other. They're falling in love with each other and committing themselves to each other is in a public arena. And here, Dad says, no way, Jose. Okay, that's not going to happen. But this community into which they enter as adults requires commitment and responsibility. When the man desires the pleasure of sex apart from the commitment and responsibility of marriage, there's a high price that must be paid. In fact, he says he must pay the bride price. Regardless of daddy gives the girl to the boy or not, he must pay the bride price. Okay, so we understand. Yeah. No, we don't understand. How much do you make per year? Okay. Don't say it out loud. Now, take that times three. That's how much he paid for his bride. Oh, this isn't just a little naughty, naughty boy, shouldn't do that. When God's people take advantage of others, God says, you can't do that and get away with it the way I've set life up. It will cost you, and it will cost you exorbitantly. He moves on from premarital sex and he talks about spiritism, a sorceress. A sorceress, he says, must not be. A sorceress is one who deals with the supernatural, trying to manipulate God or the gods, however they saw it. But the idea is, whether demonically possessed, getting in touch with the dead, somehow entering into occult practices to be able to manipulate the supernatural and impose it upon the natural. In this arena, who becomes the one who controls the power? Becomes the person, doesn't it? Okay. Even calling upon the gods, the one who's really at the center, the power seat of control there in that arena is the person who's doing the sorcering. The idea is in this that man is usurping the deity by manipulatively controlling. In fact, man is seeking to become God in this. And God says the cost for this, in entering into the supernatural and those powers that be, it's kind of interesting the way he says it. You will not be. you will not let that person continue even to exist. The next inordinate affection that he brings out is bestiality. Again, these things are sickening even to discuss. But these things God has to address because these are the things that are taking place in the land into which they go. Remember, Israel is called to be holy because what? Because their God is holy. God addresses bestiality, having sex with an animal, because in the context of the gods of the nations into which they were about to go, the gods would have intercourse with animals. And in order to enact and play out that divine drama, the people, when they came to worship, would actually involve themselves in the same disgusting practices. And God says, listen, I'm a different God. You can't worship me by acting like an animal, by being united with an animal. Man was created distinct from animals. We've all seen this picture probably more than we've wanted to throughout the week. Okay. The little boy who fell in the Cincinnati gorilla pen. What do we do? What do we shoot? Well, not the boy. Okay. Well, so they shoot the gorilla. And now what? How can you shoot a gorilla? How can you shoot a gorilla? You pull the trigger for crying out loud. Okay? It's not that hard. Why would you shoot a gorilla? You shoot a gorilla because a human life is in danger. And when it comes to the life of a gorilla or a life of a human, there's no question. Unless you think that humans came from monkeys. There's more humans than we have monkeys in this world. But if there's nothing essentially about that little monkey than that big monkey, then how do you decide? Well, you shoot the one that you have more of. They're expendable. God says, I didn't create you like an animal. I created you like myself. You can't do that. It's not just about having sex with an animal. It's about what you are created to be. And if you will refuse to image me and go to such degradations to worship me, or just to enjoy the pleasures of an animalistic nature, you've lost your right to exist. You will certainly be killed. He says, that cannot exist in my holy community. The last thing he deals with is idolatry. Idolatry is desiring to displace the deity by exchanging the true God for something less holy. Whenever I set up an idol, even Israel does in chapter 32, they build it a yearling calf. You ever seen a yearling calf? Brrr, okay? A yearling calf is like Kyle in the middle of his prime and youth. Okay? This is your God's. Brrr. God says, you can put whatever you want on that stand, but anything that you can put there is smaller than me. Anything you put there is less dignified than me. Anything you put there is less wise, less loving, less kind, less anything than me. There's a very, very interesting word that he uses with this one in particular. He's talking about idolatry, and he says, if this is what happens, verse 20, whoever sacrifices to any god other than the living God, Yahweh, alone, he shall be, it's one word, karem. He shall be devoted to destruction. He shall be isolated to the Lord for judgment, is the idea. He shall be damned. Well, that's pretty strong language. Intentionally. Even uglier than bestiality is taking our God and making him so small that Romans says they exchange the glory of the one true God for images resembling mortal man's, birds, animals, and bugs. Can you imagine worshiping a beetle? I don't get it. I don't get it. God says, listen, whenever you make me small, whatever you worship, you become like what you worship. You cannot afford to put a different God on my throne. The first thing he talks about, their community ethics, is the high price of having the wrong affections. We're going to whip through these next quickly. Number two, the high standard of divine perfection. He says in verse 20, you shall not wrong a sojourner. Verse 22, no widow or fatherless child will you mistreat. The high standard of God's perfection is that he has compassion for the oppressed. Compassion is used down in verse 27. These things you will do because I have compassion. The word compassion is to be actively gentle, to be kind. Not to be reactively kind, but to be proactively kind. Especially to one who is without help, without aid, without one in their corner to stand up on their behalf. Muhammad Ali just died yesterday. God says, I will step in and float like a butterfly and sting like a bee on behalf of these people. Because they've got nobody in their ring, nobody to stand in their corner. Those who are sojourners, the idea is those who are in the land without an inheritance. They've caught on to the true God, but there's no land designated for them. They're left to fend for themselves to some degree. The widow is the one whose husband would take care of her normally, but she's left without recourse. There's no income. She can't manage the land by herself. The other is the fatherless child, the one whose dad isn't there to provide and nurture and care and direct and instruct and to tend to their welfare. God says, I will be the father of the orphan. I will be the husband of the widow. In fact, he says just that. I will take the sojourner under my wing. I have compassion on them. He says, to the sojourner you shall do no wrong. That is, you shall not cheat them. You shall not make them weak. You shall not take advantage of their weakness. You shall not oppress them, he says. That is, to press them into a corner and to force them into your will, to press them down. You shall not mistreat the widow or the fatherless. The idea there is to cause them to be bent down, to cringe, to be violent to them, to take advantage of your power and their weakness. He says, with regard to the poor, you will not exact interest on them. You'll not keep them in that. You'll not traffic in their misery. You'll not hold them down so that they're always dependent on you. You need to give them a way out of their circumstances so they can learn how to live responsibly in the realm of my blessing. The one side of God's perfection is compassion. The opposite side of the coin, and he gives this to us down in verse 24, is God's wrath. He says, listen, if you will treat these who need special protection without protection, then I will remove all protection from you. In fact, my wrath will burn. It will kindle. I will blow on my wrath. I will ignite my wrath. The idea is so that my wrath will consume you. Here again, the punishment fits the crime. He says, I will kill you by the sword that you wield against those who are helpless. I will make your wives to be widows. I will make your children to be orphans. You will not get away with this because my wrath is an act of wrath. It's a part of my divine perfection. He says, I will certainly hear when they cry. He uses some of the same language that's used in the Exodus materials. He says, listen, just like I took care of them, and just like I've taken care of you, and because I've taken care of you, you must take care of each other. And especially those who have nobody else in their corner. You need to be their champion. You need to be their hero. You need to step in when they've got nowhere else to turn. Because that's what I've done for you. He sticks in there one little verse, verse 28, you shall not revile God or curse a ruler of your people. The idea is to blaspheme, and it's not to curse God, but to take God lightly. It's to treat him as worthless. It's not to acknowledge his full weight or his majesty. He says, it extends not just to me, but to those that I put in place of power. You need to understand that I am the champion of the weak. I am the one who works against the oppressor. I am the one who installs those who are in authority. This is what it looks like. My divine perfections, my sovereignty is at stake. So bend your goodness to my sovereignty. Number three, there's a high expectation of the benevolent redemption that God has poured out on his people. He says, when you come into the land, verse 29, you will not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest or the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You do the same with your oxen, sheep, and so on. The idea is both in your vineyards and in your fields, whatever you get, you owe me first fruits. And remember, he says back in Exodus 13, I told you, your firstborn of your womb, the firstborn of your flocks belong to me. They belong to me at a price. Life for life. The idea is that in these things, they're not to delay their gratitude. And the words that he uses is the fullness and the flowing and your firstborn. Everything that I'm giving to you, and my desire is to give, don't be reluctant to acknowledge that I'm the one who gave it to you. Don't hold on so tight and, oh, I guess I have to give it to God. Don't do that. Don't hold on to it, waiting for somebody to, the tax collector to come and take it from you, as it were, from the temple, a temple tax. Give it. Give it right away. Give it out of a glad heart. And the New Testament uses that language, a joyful heart, a hilarious heart that loves to give. Then he gives this strange command right at the very end of that chapter, verse 31. You shall be consecrated to me, therefore, don't eat flesh that's torn in the field. Throw it to the dogs. All right, I get the Ten Commandments, but why do we have this weird one right here? Again, at the beginning of this verse, he says, understand who you are. You're a holy people. I'm giving you my blessings. I'm dumping out my blessings. I'm channeling my blessings. Now, when something by my divine providence is ripped apart and torn apart in the field, you don't have to go and gather up all the fragments like a beggar, and because you've got nothing else. And you've got to hoard the little resources that you have. I'm in charge of everything you possess. If in my sovereignty, my providence, my wisdom, I've allowed something to be torn by the field, a dirty creature, by the way, would be the one who tore it. It would defile them because of the eating of this dirty meat. But bigger than that, he says, listen, I give you so many blessings. You don't have to gather up the scraps and scavenge a blessing, as it were. My hand is open to you. You have a responsibility to me because my redemption toward you is benevolent. Number four, he starts out the next chapter and lays out some rules for the priority of resolving conflicts within their community through justice. He starts out at the very beginning, verse 1, you shall not spread a false report. That is, justice is grounded in truth. And before he even moves into the court of law, he says this as a blank command, a blank statement, because he's not just talking inside the court, he's talking in the backyard, over the fence, in the church foyer. What he's talking about is gossip. He's talking about that which brings down a man's character, a man's reputation. It's spreading a rumor that may not be true, or if true, is non-beneficial, because he continues, you shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. Malicious is the word Hamas. You ever heard of Hamas? Huh? You shall not be malicious. You shall not be Hamas. You shall not be injurious. You shall not be violent. You shall not be harsh, ruthless, wild, noisy, tearing down somebody else for your own benefit. You will not be Hamas. Not in my kingdom. Justice is nurtured in goodwill. Justice is wary of public opinion. A true democracy, God says no. A democracy is only for those who are governed by morality. But God says, even within my kingdom, the majority will often be wrong. So don't give in to public opinion. Don't give in to peer pressure. You do what's right. Don't join hands, is the word that he used, with the many. The many who are easily swayed, the many who would utilize and manipulate things to their own advantage. Justice is oblivious to economics. He says, don't favor the poor. Verse 3. You shall not be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. Verse 6. But don't pervert the justice that's due the poor man in his lawsuit. So don't favor the poor man, but don't bludgeon the poor man. Okay? Don't favor the rich. Don't favor the poor. Both play by the same rules. Don't, out of pity, side with the poor man. Don't take affirmative action, is the idea, on his behalf. Both must play by my same rules. Justice, then, is accountable before God's divinity. Look at how he says it up in verse 7. Keep far away from a false charge. Do not kill the innocent. Do not kill the righteous, because I'm the one who still has to pass judgment on any judgment you pass. God says, listen, justice will be meted out, and if it's not by you, it will be by me. Lastly, number 5, there's the high demands of holy imitation. In this text, we see two in particular that he says, I want you to focus on these in particular. Look at verse 4 and 5. If you meet your whose ox going astray, your enemies. And just so you don't get the wrong idea, he underlines it a little bit more. Verse 5. If you see the donkey of one who, oh, that kind of enemy. Okay. The enemy, the one who hates you. Ryken says, usually people hurt their enemies. That's what an enemy is, someone we hate and therefore think somebody it's okay to abuse. God wants us to treat our enemies as we treat our friends. One of the distinguishing marks of the followers of Jesus is that they do good to those who hate them. This is something we can't do by ourselves, folks. That's why it reveals a God who's inside of us. The second realm of people that he says I want you to be careful about is verse 9. Again, he returns to the sojourner. Do not oppress a sojourner, because you know the heart of a sojourner. You know what it's like to not fit in. I want you to be active in your service to those who are opposed to you. I want you to be indiscriminate in the compassion you display to those that I'm bringing in to be a part of you. But they're not Jews. No. But they're mine. They don't look like you. They don't sound like you. They don't play like you. They don't smell like you. They don't eat like you. But they're mine. And I want you to treat them as brothers. You know what? This is what God has done for us. He's extended his grace to us as enemies. I love Romans chapter 5, verse 8. But God commendeth his love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. In fact, verse 10 uses the word enemies before God. And God turned his love on us. And then the fact, Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, that in the fullness of time God sent forth his Son to be born of a woman born under the law to redeem those who are under the law. And to bring them into adoption as sons. Those who were outsiders, he made insiders so that they might be very citizens of heaven with himself. You know, it's amazing that this text, it's 3,500 years old, but it's absolutely relevant to us today. It addresses the areas of sex and violence. It addresses the attitudes of ingratitude and manipulation. It addresses areas of unholiness and justice. Gossiping and peer pressure, prejudice, discrimination. Boy, you'd think he meant for us to have this today. A holy people will never stand out as great, my friend, unless we, as God's holy people, learn to stand up and do good. We can't do it by ourselves. But because of this, we can and we must. And one of the most discouraging things about this year's election is that despite all the sloganeering, we're left with two candidates that really know nothing about goodness. As a result, we're guaranteed that our country will soon experience an eclipse of true greatness. That's just the way it is. But you know what? As we come to this table, this is what true greatness looks like. It's putting myself down to lift others up. It's trusting in the sovereignty of God when it looks like all hell is breaking loose, but heaven is breaking through. It's hard. It hurts. You're going to be tempted to quit. And you do. And you're tempted to complain. And we do. And you're tempted to sin. And we do. That's why Jesus died on that cross. You see, what God's called us to do, we can't do. That's why He had to send His Son to do it for us. That's why we rejoice in beholding wondrous things from God's law. The men are going to assemble and they're going to come forward in just a minute. Before they do, we're just going to take a quiet time. Examine your heart. I'm sure the things that we've talked about today, some of them you don't struggle with. But probably some of them you do. No, definitely some of them you do. All of them are conquered by Jesus. Let's pray.